The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
So once again, welcome everybody, and special thanks to John for being here tonight. Many of you probably already know John, but in case you don't, he's one of our matriarchs of Buddhism here in the Twin Cities. Been a 40-year practitioner, longtime student of Katagiri Roshi, who founded the Minnesota Zen Center back in the early 70s and ordained with Katagiri Roshi, and got Dharma transmission before he died, I guess around 1989. And he also spent a year practicing at Amaravati, Theravada Monastery in England, started by Ajahn Sumedho. Practice with the nuns there, and also has more recently practiced with Thich Nhat Hanh, both in France and here in the States. And she and her husband Michael O'Neill have founded the Compassionate Ocean Dharma Center, and they teach the Zen students over in Northeast Minneapolis, their new home, soon to be new home, in their studio, where they are now. And it's great to have you here, John. And the title of the talk is The Blooming of the Dharma Flower. I'm looking forward to that bloom.
Well, thank you for coming tonight. I don't know if it was wise, but... And please be careful driving home. And thank you to all the unseen beings here tonight. And... all the people that are snug as a bug in a rug at home. Thank you to them too. And thank you very much to Common Ground. Common Ground gave us a home on Friday mornings for about 10 years. We were over in the old Common Ground, and then we moved over to the new Common Ground. So this really is Common Ground. Anyway, we really appreciate your generosity. Yeah. Okay. Unfolding of the Dharma Flower is the name, one of the names of the Lotus Sutra. It's because it's easier for people, rather than saying the unfolding of the Dharma flower, unfolding of the lotus flower, over the years, last 2,000 years or so, it's come to be known as the Lotus Sutra. And Michael and I, and also Sosan Flynn, have been teaching that sutra this fall, and enjoying it very much, so I wanted to share it with you tonight. Can you hear me? Okay. So the Lotus Sutra is one of the world's great religious texts. It's also a very key text in East Asian Buddhism. It hasn't been taught so much in the United States. It's very fantastical in many ways. And for some reason or other, teachers thought maybe it was too far out. Little did they know, but anyway. My teacher taught it for 3 years in the 70s. Over 3 years during morning practice periods. So very happy to come back to it. This sutra was said to take place on Vulture Peak, and it really emphasizes the historical dimension and the ultimate dimension, and how to live in the historical dimension, touching into the ultimate dimension. So the sutra kind of goes back and forth. And you're sitting there for a moment with a few of the bodhisattvas and the Buddha, and then all of a sudden 10 million billion bodhisattvas appear and spring up from out of the earth. So you have to have a flexible mind, a flexible heart to study and appreciate the Lotus Sutra. So tonight I wanted to concentrate on the parable of the burning house. In the Lotus Sutra there are many stories and parables. In order to help us to understand the Buddha's teachings. Many wonderful stories and parables, some of which are very well known and are echoed in other religious parables. So the burning house, let's see. So one time there was this old house on this large property that was owned by a father with many children. And it was really old house. I mean, the pillars were all falling down and the foundation was eaten out and it was filled with mice and centipedes and demons, few demons here and there howling. Anyway, it was a terrible place and it was not up to code. But of course, the children of the father were drawn to that house. And I don't know how it was when you were a youth, but when I was a youth, we were, as children, we were very drawn to houses like this. I was brought up in the outskirts of Washington, D.C. And I remember as a child, you know, going into these houses that were all creaking, falling apart, and just thinking it was wonderful. Anyway, so these children went into this house and they quickly got absorbed in the world of this house and in all the games that they could make up with all the beings in this house. I mean, in the sutra it says, you know, 500 humans as well as all these, nefarious beings were there. And packs of wild dogs. I remember that. So, anyway, the children were sort of thrilled to be there. And they were very involved in playing in this house. And their father happened to walk by, and someone that was outside said to him, "You know, I saw your children going into this house." And he's like, "My children in that terrible house?" You know? And then just at that moment, the whole house burst into flames. The father ran into the house and shouted for the children, "This is a terrible place and it's on fire. Please come out. Please come out now. Come out now." But the children were so absorbed in their games that they didn't even look up. You know? And so the father thought, "Well, maybe I could try to, by force." But there were a whole lot of them and they were in various parts of the house. So he thought to himself, "What shall I do?" And then he said, "Oh, I know." He said, "Children, children, guess what? I have wonderful toys for you outside the house. And not only ordinary toys, but special toys. Carriages." And all the children really loved carriages. And he said, "Carriages pulled by horses and goats and deer and oxen, many kinds of carriages. And if you come out, you can all have a carriage to play in." So they immediately rushed out of the house. So that's the main part of the story. So, of course, this is a Buddhist parable, so the father is the Buddha, and the children The children are all of us who get into terrible trouble in the Saha world. The other day, Michael told us that Saha meant barely tolerable. So we're the Buddhist children in this barely tolerable Saha samsaric world. And we're very stubborn. Kathakiri Roshi used to say, a stubbornness of ego. He says, you all have great stubbornness of ego. And our Sangha, Mark mentioned, in the early 70s started, and we were all young. I mean, it was young Sangha, like 20s, people in their 20s. And of course, we got into terrible trouble. And we would go into Kathakiri Roshi and say, Roshi, please help me. You know, this is a terrible thing is happening. And he would say, you know, don't do this, do that. You know? But then we would leave the room and do the opposite of whatever he said. So in a talk one day, he said, people come to me and ask me for advice, and I tell them what I think is best, but they do the opposite. So that was my experience as a young person, And of course, we all suffered a lot. And when once we'd sort of really, really, really reached the bottom of suffering, then we say, now, what did you say? What did you say? Anyway, so the father tried calling out, but there was no response. So as I was thinking about this subject earlier in the day, I thought of the Vinaya, which are the 200 and something rules, precepts for the monks. And you might, you know, think that the monks were pretty good, and every once in a while they stumble a little bit, but actually the monks weren't so good often. I mean, if you read the Vinaya, you'll laugh out loud if you read the commentary of the Vinaya, because they got into terrible trouble. In fact, in those days there were teenagers in the Sangha, and there was a gang of 17. It's referred to as you're reading the Vinaya. You know, teenagers, and they just got into terrible trouble. You know, so a lot of the rules of the Vinaya are directed to these teenagers. So one time one of the senior monks went to the Buddha and he said, you know, I've heard that these monks are throwing rice balls during the meal. And the Buddha said, well, have them come to me. So they all came. He said, I've heard that you've been throwing rice balls during the meal. He said, yes, Lord, that's true. We have been throwing rice balls. So then one of the precepts is, a follower of the Buddha shall not throw rice balls during the meal. So even the Buddha had great trouble with these young people. So the house, the burning, the house is our senses and our skandhas and the poisons, greed, anger, self-delusion, old age, a birth, sickness, old age, death, despair. Anyway, all of those are part of the burning house. And I think the third sermon that the Buddha gave was the fire sermon. And he said, he gave it, this is very interesting, he gave it to 1,000 fire ascetics, you know, ascetics who were really into fire. So he decided, using skillful means, that he would talk about fire. So he told them, you know, that your eye is on fire, your nose is on fire, your mouth, the object of your eye, the object of your nose, and all the senses, and all of your life is really on fire, is really burning. So anyway, so this is the burning house. We're in the burning house right now. Now, a practice center is a little bit cooled down. All the fire department is here, you know, trying to calm the flames. But still, you know, as we were driving over, we saw several accidents, and there were, you know, sirens going off, and Michael and I, who've been practicing for many years, gotten a little tiff about winter driving. And anyway, so there's a little flame that came out. So the Buddha did use skillful means. Just like the father used skillful means in going into the house and saying, "Toys, I have toys for you." You know, the Buddha did use skillful means. After his enlightenment under the Bodhi tree, he thought, I can't teach this. I don't know. He didn't know really what to do with his deep insight. And Thich Nhat Hanh says he did walking meditation by the river, up and down. And then the story goes that Brahma came from Brahma heaven and said to him, "There are beings with little dust in their eyes. So please teach. Please go out and teach." So then the Buddha had to think, you know, how to skillfully present something of what he had seen. So he gave his first sermon, which is on the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering and its cause, and the truth of happiness, ease, and joy, and its way. So that was the Buddha's very, very skillful means that are still coming down to us today. You know? So the children rush out of the house, and the father is out of the house, and then the father's kind of resting. He's kind of resting on a fence post, and he says, "These children were difficult to raise." He says, "Ignorant, young, and foolish, they went into the house. Now I have rescued them, and I am very happy." But as soon as he says that, and he's sort of getting a moment of rest and mindfulness, gathering himself together, the children cry out, "You promised us toys. You said we'd get carts. We want our carts." So the Buddha, the father and the Buddha, we don't get a lot of rest, you know. So the children want their carts, and the father said, "Oh, okay." And he brings out this one beautiful, bejeweled and bedecked cart pulled by gleaming white oxen. And all the children were, "Wow, this is really good." So they all ran out and ran into the cart, jumped into the cart, and they were very happy in the cart. So the one, this one carriage represents the one vehicle of the Buddha, the Ekka Buddhayana. Ekka probably means one. Buddhayana. So this is kind of a metaphor that we're all part of the Buddha's lineage. We're all part of the Buddha's family. And we can all get together in a great cart, in the family cart. Now we have family cars, but this is a family cart. And all the children came out. They were all together there. So the Lotus Sutra came forward. It's said to be the last teaching of the Buddha on Vulture Peak, but it appeared at the beginning of the Common Era. So that was, what, 500 or 600 years after the Buddha died. And anyway, there's a lot to say about that, but I won't tonight. But anyway, the Lotus Sutra, which is really, the whole sutra is skillful means. The Lotus Sutra itself is a skillful means to unite all of the Buddhist family at that time. You know, you've studied that after the Buddha died, and then there were splits, and then there were, you know, 18 schools and 32 schools and schools within schools, and then there was a big movement called the Mahayana, and then, you know, there's arguing. So this sutra was really presented at a time, or came forward, or appeared at a time to say, you know, we're all together in this. We're all together in this one yana, the Ekka Buddhayana. Maybe you've never heard that. So that's a nice term. So the Lotus Sutra really tries to reconcile all these myriad movements and views and opinions that were coming up at that time. And it also points to Buddhism as a living reality. It's wonderful that Buddhism is a living reality. It's always changing according to causes and conditions. So the basic idea is that we're bathed in Buddhist compassion, that we're not cut off or separate. No, I just noticed. Often I don't have notes, but tonight I thought, well, I'm coming to visit a relative, so I should be more prepared. I realize I skipped page 2 entirely, so we'll have to go back. So I'm not a member of a young sangha. No, my sangha's old. No. They were young when we started. They were younger, but, you know. So I was telling Michael that the other day I made a doctor's appointment, and I was going to the doctor. One of the things on my list was, I'm having trouble with my memory, so I better talk to the doctor. So I went to the doctor, and the receptionist said, "Oh, you're an hour late." Okay. So I want to go back and talk about a few of the things I skipped. Before I go back and go on, do you have any comment or question? Or story? One thing I wanted to mention about the fire, the metaphor, the image, or the reality of fire, and that's that in the last couple of months there have been, I think, 9 Tibetan monks and 1 nun, 8 Tibetan monks and 1 nun, who have immolated themselves. And they immolated themselves to make a big flame, to sort of make a big light so that people could see the poison that they were being forced to drink and to endure. So that's another discussion, the topic of immolation, but that's also during the Vietnam War. Very moving, I think a very moving image that changed a lot of things for the Vietnamese and for all of us, was the image of monks immolating themselves. And the pictures were taken and appeared, you know, on front pages. And so we all sort of saw that. We woke up in the morning and opened the paper, and there was that image. So I think anyway, those monks and nuns were really making a light to shine onto their situation. So sometimes someone in some very difficult situation needs to make a fire so that people can see the fire, you know, can see what's happening in the world and in their own body and mind. And I wanted to say a few words about upaya, which is the Pali or Sanskrit and Pali word for skillful means, sometimes called expedient means or skill in means or skill in liberative technique or compassionate means. So it's very important for all of us to know that if we want to, all of these liberative techniques were for liberation, you know, pointing towards liberation. When we first start studying Buddhism, we, as young people, I know, we wanted to rush home and tell our parents all about it. So sometimes we weren't very skillful. Our parents worried about us. So upaya is one of the paramitas. I think in Pali it's paramis, and it's a little different list than the Sanskrit paramitas. Am I getting this right? Okay, Sanskrit, Pali. But the first one, you know, is giving, generosity, and precepts, and patience. And Thich Nhat Hanh translates patience as inclusiveness, which is a very wonderful way to translate patience, the kshanti, as inclusiveness. So we don't just bear something, but we include it in the mandala of our life. So that's very nice. And then energy, energetic practice. I said to someone the other day, you know, they were struggling with depression. I said, you know, you have to put a lot of energy into dealing with your depression. You can't just passively, you know, sort of go into it. You have to rise up and meet it. Dear little depression, I know you are there, and I'm here for you. You can say that. And then meditation, steady meditation, and prajna, wisdom, and then upaya comes next. So that's skillful means. So these are like, what should I do? We ask, you know, what should I do? Well, you could start off with giving. Give something. Sometimes giving means giving up. Someone, I think Pema Chodron says, letting go of holding back. That's very nice. Okay. I'd like to hear about you and your stubbornness of ego. Not the only one, am I? And your burning house. And your carriages, carts. Your wonderful carts. And your skillful means. Or your unskillful means. Sometimes it's helpful to look at our unskillful means, and then we can cross those off. No, that's not, that didn't work very well. What will work for me? Good.
Allow me to go in and throw me a whole bunch of glass bottles. I think that's interesting. Practice and everything.
Well, one thing, you can have another silent option. We had lots of treasures that came. But in our Sangha, a couple of times we've had circles where everyone did just that. We brought in something that was really, that we treasured, but and that we wanted to share to someone, with someone else. And so the person, there was a table with all these things, and then one at a time we'd go back and pick something from the table. And then the person that gave it would say something about it after it was chosen. And the person that chose it would say why they were drawn to it. Anyway, so that was a very helpful exercise, because we had to think carefully, you know. Well, we don't want to just, you know, all of the junk, but something we want to, you know, give our heart. So we give something that was close to our heart, you know, that we felt some kind of heart attachment to, but through the practice realized that we could do without. You know? Anyway, that's a very nice practice. And I try to practice that a lot, you know, just giving away my treasures to people I love and people that I think would appreciate them or need them in some way, or need the love that goes with it. When you give something and someone receives it, you know, there's a love there.
Do you have any thoughts to share about why we kids like to go on those houses? Yeah, just that attraction for just your reflections on that part of the mind or heart that is curious and wants and likes drama. What have you learned? Just to that part of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, we know our mothers wouldn't like it. As soon as we see the house, we hear the voice of our mother saying, "Don't go in." And then we think, "Oh, I want to." So that's stubbornness of ego. You know, like when Katagiri Roshi would say, "Don't do this," then we would do that. You know, I would do it. And it's some of my, we would do it. So it's a stubbornness of ego. I really like that expression because it really, you can feel that. You know, if you just say ego, you know, but stubbornness of ego, we can really feel that we want to do what we want to do. And we don't want to do what our mother tells us and what our teacher tells us. You know, we want to do what we want to do, at least when we're young. As we get older and suffered more than we remember, all that good advice. You know, so that's one thing that we're drawn to. That we're drawn to say yes to the voice that says no, or no to the voice that says yes. So, and then, I don't know, I can remember as a child just the, as you say, drama of, you know, going into, maybe it's a reflection of, you know, going into that shadow part of ourselves. You know, that I was brought up in a very Leave It to Beaver kind of time and house. Well, I wouldn't say my family was exactly Leave It to Beaver, but, you know, there wasn't a lot of emphasis on looking at our unconscious or our subconscious. And there was a lot of emphasis on the gloss of... So, at that time, it was a way to sort of go into that shadow part. You know, I mean, when you went into these houses, you could, you know, there was a feeling like it describes in the Lotus Sutra, you know, that things were a little awry and you could feel the sort of spirits, the hungry ghosts and the other spirits kind of not settled. Because often in these houses, I don't know if they have houses like this. Well, yes, there's lots of foreclosed houses and that kind of thing, but... I remember these houses would have belongings in them. They wouldn't just be empty houses. So, you know, it was opening a gate that we couldn't find a way to open in our regular lives. I mean, I think it's different now for people, for children, you know. We say, "How does that make you feel?" You know. But when I was growing up, no one ever said, "How does that make you feel?" You know. So anyway, we could... and also it was like going under the storyline. So it has a spiritual aspect of, you know, it's outside our story. And it's it's not really under the storyline, but it's under our storyline. Going into another aspect of our psyche. What do you think?
Yeah, and I'm just kind of relating what you're saying to my own experience, even now, not even when I'm young, but like when you what you said first about when our parents say yes, we say no. And yeah, I see so many ways I do that. Like if somebody drives from here to there this way, it's like I take a real pleasure in doing it a different way, just to be different. I mean, there's just something, and I say, oh yeah, that's. It's like a way of establishing a sense of significance, sort of a uniqueness, you know. Mm-hmm. So maybe that, because I wasn't that obviously rebellious for a number of reasons. I wasn't around my parents that much when I was in high school. But I had that piece, you know, it's like doing it my own way and finding real some kind of juice doing it my own way as opposed to doing what everyone else is doing. And I just wasn't that interested. It's like immediately, and it wasn't that what people were doing wasn't interesting. It was because people were doing it that I wasn't so interested in it, I think, part at least. So yeah, I see that. And I think it relates to the second point you made, that part of it was just stubbornness, stubbornness of the ego. And I think part of it was the mystery of doing, you know, doing something else, like trying some maybe not so conscious sense that there's something to discover, and wanting to sort of go other places to see what there was.
Right. How about you, Michael?
Oh, I agree.
Do you want to add anything?
listening to Mark, listening to you, I was just reflecting on all, or not all, but lots of flashes of my stubbornness of ego. So I don't have any grand theory about why that is, but I don't think it's not all unwholesome. When I reflect on a given day like today, if I look at it, there's lots of it that's sort of pretty wholesome, and then there's lots of other things that are less wholesome or generous and kind. So it's not like we're one or the other. but it's kind of like that's our the territory that we work with. Sort of cause less trouble for ourselves and others. That's all I have to say at this time.
I'm working with kids. I'm a teacher, and I have a really difficult class this quarter. The hardest class that I've ever had, or the hardest kid that I've ever worked with, that constantly, every day, it's like a real struggle to get through just the hour that I have that particular class. And it's really difficult to find any skill in relating to them. Even though, you know, in my practice, I spend a lot of time, well, not that I'm reflecting on that, but I try to bring that, like, peace and clarity into those relationships and into my daily life and into my classroom. But I find myself almost instantaneously caught in this fire of reactivity where the kids are just like, they just, you know, they cause these conflicts among themselves, and it falls to me to sort of put that out and it happens so fast and it's so intense, and immediately my like anger surfaces, and in a sense it's really clear to me that I'm suffering a lot, and that I can feel that anger really distinctly, but it's really tough to even though there's that awareness to be skillful in that moment and not just, you know, react in a controlling or reactive way that doesn't cause any, you know, isn't coming from a loving place. Or,
how old are your kids, the kids in your class?
They're sixth graders, so they're 11 and 12.
You know about teaching, yeah. Well, one thing I found is that, you know, I teach the class, Michael and I teach the class that you give here, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and we've taught it for 17 years. And this time in my class, you know, they're all adults, but I had two younger people, meaning two people in their 20s that were in the class. And I found that they would come whenever they wanted. I mean, you know, they'd show up an hour late or 2 hours late. And they would just get up and leave whenever they wanted to. And, you know, I was kind of stunned. And one time I called someone. I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I just feel like leaving now." I said, "Well, that's kind of rude." And then he left, and then I asked around all my friends, and I have a friend that has been a professor at St. Thomas, a philosophy professor, and she finally quit because she said that's what the kids are like now, that they come and go whenever they feel like it. You know, they do what they feel like. And then I talked to also a professor at St. Thomas, and then the parents in the class told me that their young people they don't feel as much of a sense of community because they're so focused in on technology that, you know, like one of these guys in my class who's really wonderful, and I thought, oh, this practice would be so wonderful for him. And he said, "Well, we pay for it so we can come whenever we want." See, that's one of the advantages of charging. But anyway, so I think the sixth graders, you know, that age, they've absorbed that kind of feeling. I'm just talking. I don't know for sure. I haven't done a sociological study, but from my brief experience that. And I have a friend that teaches high school, and he talks about the same kind of thing. So, you weren't raised with technology, or maybe you were. I don't know how old you are, but, you know.
I wasn't raised, but I wasn't super, like, sucked into it. Yeah, and I just feel like there's a lot of anger and stuff with like these particular kids, and I know that some of them have been through, you know, I found out that one of the kids' parents had shot himself, one of his dad, and he came upon that scene and stuff, and for me that was a real like shift in perception, you know. It's like the teaching of how, for one, you look at something and think it's one way, and then you see it a different way, and you have a totally different perspective of that. And now my relationship with him is like, he's really disrupted in my class, but I'm like, you've got, you know, like, I just give him everything I can, you know, and I don't, I don't have any problem giving him, you know, compassion and love.
Mm-hmm.
And but so I mean, I've known that there's a lot of other issues, and maybe, you know, if it was every kid that I could see these hard parts of their life, and you know, then it's like, why do I need that, like, to, you know, really? It's like, for me, that for that one kid that unlocked, like, this deep compassion that erased any aversion or aggression, like anger or aggression that I had towards him or his behavior.
Yeah. So, what's your name?
My name's Owen.
Owen? So, Owen, yes. That helped you to touch compassion. So, maybe these naughty kids in your class are great bodhisattvas coming to help you touch the depth of your own heart. Anyway, your whole classroom's on fire, so you have to be the fireman. How does, you know, the fireman has to be skillful putting out the fire. So you've already touched a really important point to look deeply and understand. But all of these kids are coming from houses that are on fire, you know. And you're also...
Yeah, my house is on fire.
Yeah. So you need to, as you know, keep putting out your own fire, and also giving the kids a chance to talk together as a class about their fires. So they know, they all know that they're suffering together. So Thich Nhat Hanh has four mantras. The first mantra is, "Darling, I'm here for you." Now he says, "Darling," but we could say, "Honey," or, you know, "John," or whatever. "I'm here for you." So that's the most important teaching, or that's the most important mantra. You know, you say, "I'm here for you," and to really mean it. And one of the other mantras is, "Darling, you're suffering. That's why I'm here for you." And then the fourth one is, "Darling, I'm suffering. Please help me." So sometimes you could tell your class, you know, you could say, "Kids, I'm having a hard time now. Could you help me? What are some ways that I could skillfully help you?" Anyway, it's helpful for other people to know that we're suffering too, and we need help. So I think teachers in this day and age, they need to be able to practice that fourth mantra, which is, "I'm suffering, please help me." But you have to start out with, "I'm here for you." And then if people hear that, then they, they relax a little bit. I don't know, is there some time frame?
Oh, you should wrap up around 8:30, thereabouts.
Okay.
After one more, a couple more comments or questions?
Yeah. Because it's very dramatic, and well, sutras are traditionally thought to be, said to be, the teaching of the Buddha, and then some sutras arose, and people said, "Well, the Buddha has died, you know, so how could this be a teaching of the Buddha?" And because you asked, I'll say, according to Mahayana Buddhism, these teachings were hidden in the depths of the sea and guarded by the Nagas, the dragons of the deep ocean. And when the time was ripe, you know, these sutras emerged. And so, as you know, probably you can guess that some people would have trouble with that idea. But the Lotus Sutra is one of those sutras. And it's very, you know, it does talk, this sutra, in, you know, very dramatic, vivid terms that weren't so, I don't know the right words to use, but different from source Buddhism. Different from the original teachings of the Buddha, having a different feeling tone of sort of blowing your mind in a way, because you know the scenes where the past Buddha will appear and have, and the Buddha will go up and have a conversation with this past Buddha whose name is Abundant Treasures, and then he'll invite all the Buddha's disciples and all the bodhisattvas and all the people that were there. He'll raise them up so they can also be in the conversation. So you see things like that that were had a different tone than the early Buddhist teachings. So. Anyway, that's probably a reason. And I remember studying this, and you know, I was a child of the 60s and 70s, and you know, didn't blow my mind at all. I thought, oh yeah. But here's a story that. When we were studying the Lotus Sutra, it was always during the middle of these practice periods, and they would start at 4:30 in the morning. And so we'd get up at 4 and go over to the Zen Center, and then someone would give a talk. If you can imagine giving a talk at 4:30 in the morning, but we did it. There were about 20 of us that would do those practice periods, and so I remember one night I was at home, and I was just, I have two daughters, and one of my daughters was somewhere else. I don't know where the father was, but the youngest daughter was there with me, and it was just a very calm evening, and I was studying the Lotus Sutra, and I felt my heart mind just opened up. You know, I felt so wonderful. Happy to be in the world of the Lotus Sutra, to be in Buddha's wonderful world. And my youngest daughter, Elizabeth, she would say, you know, Mom, when is Anna May coming home? And I'd say, well, I don't know, but probably soon. And then she'd come back a few minutes later, when is she coming home? I said, well, I don't know. You know, she should be here any minute now. And I thought, oh, you know, she misses her sister, and you know, anyway, this whole sort of scene that was there, and it's very lovely. And then all of a sudden, the sister, older sister, who was about 6 or 7, you know, came home, and my youngest daughter ran down the stairs, and I heard her saying, "Mom," she said, Anna Mae. She said, there were two cookies left, and Mom gave them both to me. And then I heard this, Mom! In the bottom of the stairs. And anyway, I just laughed out loud. You know, just the world of the Lotus Sutra completely held that. And I remember Dosha Port, who was one of the practitioners that would meet early in the morning, he said to me, I missed the first one, so he was giving me advice about these early morning talks, and he said, whatever you do, don't try to tell a joke. 4:30 in the morning, people aren't not up to that. But I went the next morning and I told that story. Everyone laughed. Anyway, that's a Lotus Sutra memory that I have. Whenever I read the Lotus Sutra, I think of my daughters who are now almost 40. And they're still sort of, Mom! You know? Anyway. Well, thank you very much for coming, and please drive very, very carefully. Going home.
Thank you, Sharon.
Oh, and one more thing. I have a present for Common Ground. Maybe you read in our newsletter that I've been framing them. This is a picture of Ananda.
Very sweet.
Yeah, I think it's a lovely picture.
Oh,
so.
What a beautiful home for it.
Yes.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
That is going to make people warm and deep inside for many years. Is it, do you know where the statue is from?
It might say on the back. I think it says on the back. I can't remember that particular one.
Oh, lots of information. Okay. I'll make a copy of that so we can have it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks again for coming.
Okay. Thank you.
Good night, everyone.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.